is a leading anti-imperialist voice and visited the Gaza Strip in 2012 and 2013. Thank you both for being here. Youssef, I want to start with you. It's good to have you back on the program, of course. An extension of this so-called truce, this time only into Thursday. Your thoughts, what did you make of it?
Well, this temporary humanitarian pause is important for the people of Gaza to give them some relief after 49 days of relentless Israeli bombardment day and night, which killed approximately 20,000 so far. I think Israel was forced to accept this truce because it did not achieve any of its stated goal, which is to uproot Hamas and to release the hostages. And also because of the international pressure, Israel was forced to cease its military operations across Gaza because the world was horrored and shocked by the heartbreaking videos, the children torn to pieces, the unacceptable humanitarian tragedy that is being waged by Israel, collectively punishing the population. So I think this truce might be extended because, again, Israel is not going to achieve any of its goals. And I think also there is nothing else to bomb in Gaza. Mm-hmm. So if they resume this military operation, they will only kill civilians.
They will only kill civilians. Vanessa, what do you make of this extension of the truce by a couple of days, not permanently?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are ongoing negotiations in Doha, Qatar, right now with the head of the CIA, William Burns, and the head of Mossad, to see if there is some way to get further Israeli hostages released and to further extend the so-called truce. Although the Zionist forces in the north, I believe today, have actually broken the ceasefire and were responded to by the Qassam brigades. It's also worth noting that the humanitarian relief that is kind of trickling into Gaza is only 1/5 of requirements, even under normal circumstances, not under the absolutely horrific, horrendous circumstances that the Gazan people are now living with. And with largely the withdrawal of, for example, the UNRWA staff and officers from central and northern Gaza to southern Gaza, Euromed Monitor has made the point that effectively they're complicit with the Israeli plans to ethnically cleanse Gaza of Palestinians and to force them into the Sinai Desert, which has been the proclaimed plan by a number of Israeli government officials. So I'm less optimistic that the war is not going to start again, or rather I wouldn't call it a war, I would call it an ethnic cleansing. Netanyahu wrote a personal piece for the Jerusalem Post 2 days ago, and it was very clear from that piece that he perceives this as some kind of course, religious cultist war. He's been calling the Palestinians Amalek. We know what that means. It means the extermination of all Palestinians that are, of course, encapsulated as Hamas. Although we know that Hamas is not the only resistance faction that has risen up against the Zionist occupation. And that is one of the reasons, of course, that this war is being spun as Israel against Hamas, because it identifies the enemy both in Western perception and in political spheres in order to justify the continued targeting of the people of Gaza.
Exactly. The massacre of so many thousands of Palestinians, many of them children. Youssef, you are from Gaza. You've lived there through repeated cycles of Israeli violence. Compare what happened in the past 7 weeks with all the previous ones. You reported from there, I recall. We were on air together.
Yes, indeed. I reported on the first Israeli war on Gaza, the second, 2008-2012. And those two wars that I experienced, it was a joke compared to this war. This is an all-out aggression, a war that no other wars. I think it's the worst massacre in our modern history since the Second World War. And the amount of bombs, we're talking about 1.5, the equivalent size of Hiroshima bomb dropped on Gaza.
Yeah.
flattening.
In this span of 7 weeks. Yeah,
yeah, entire neighborhoods were flattened to the ground. And the northern part of Gaza especially is uninhabitable now. You're talking about 1.7 million people. They become internally displaced. So yeah. This genocidal war is Israel's revenge because it suffered a heavy blow on the 7th of October. And from the first moment, Netanyahu and his army generals, they painted a picture that Gaza is a hub of terrorism.
Yeah.
And Hamas is using Gazans as human shields, and children of Gaza are children of darkness, and people support the resistance. So he decided, okay, let's carry out carpet bombing,
yeah.
Kill everybody. I heard some Israeli officials or even commentators, they said we must kill at least 100,000 Palestinians. Mm-hmm. So Gaza is considered the capital of resistance. So when people under occupation, under siege for the past 17 years,
yeah.
And they decided to infiltrate the border and revenge 75 years of ethnic cleansing and suffering and atrocities.
It was a reaction to that.
It was a reaction to that. Yeah. Often the Western media, they don't mention the context. Yeah. They just focus on do you condemn Hamas and what happened. So this war is a very devastating war, and I think it will take some time to rebuild Gaza. I was in Gaza 2 months ago. 2 months before the war, I documented my trip being away from London, from Gaza, and this beauty, this nice places, it's all vanished. Israel has a goal to depopulate Gaza and ethnically link the people of Gaza.
And you have family there too, right?
To Sinai. Yes, my family is there. My parents,
your family
siblings.
Doing?
They suffer like the rest of the population. We were not able to communicate for over a week, sometimes for over 10 days over the course of 50 days ago. But they suffer not only because they survived, it's because every day they survived was a miracle. They had to go through this psychological impact and stress and bombardment and being starved. People cannot find now food, although they have the money.
Yeah.
Gaza is still under siege. Israel is still in full control of Gaza's airspace, territorial waters, and border crossings. Yeah. And the aid that is being trickled into Gaza is nothing. It's not
going
to alleviate the suffering.
Yeah, a drop in the bucket, for sure. And one of the places, or one of the many places that were bombed were UN facilities. And the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has welcomed the extension of the ceasefire that would have expired Monday. He called the two-day pause, quote, a glimpse of hope and humanity in the darkness of war. He also commented on the possibility of Israel opening the so-called Kerem Shalom crossing that would enable much-needed aid to enter Gaza. The UN chief also speculated on the future of Gazan leadership post-war, comments that will surely rankle some Palestinians.
It's a glimpse of hope and humanity in the middle of the darkness of war. And I strongly hope that this will enable us to increase even more the humanitarian aid to the people in Gaza that is suffering so much, knowing that even with that additional amount of time, it will be impossible to satisfy all the dramatic needs of the population in Gaza. Well, first of all, I'm sincerely hopeful that it will be possible to have other crossings because they will facilitate the distribution and that will also facilitate the control by the Israeli side. So I'm very hopeful that this will happen. A Palestinian Authority, hopefully in the day after, and as I mentioned, we will need to look seriously into how the transition takes place, and obviously the before has implications on the after, and so it is still early to know exactly how things will happen. But I believe that we need a Palestinian Authority with the responsibility to rule in Gaza, in the West Bank, and to create the conditions to make sure that the two-state solution moves forward, and this time moves forward in a way that is irreversible. And so, obviously, this will naturally lead to a strengthened Palestinian Authority, and I believe the international community should be ready to support it.
Vanessa Bealey, your reaction to Mr. Guterres' comments that they want the PA to take over in Gaza and all the rest of it.
Yeah, I mean, really, that was, listening to it, I mean, it's just a huge word salad. You know, the UN appears to be completely powerless when faced with bringing to bear international law against the Zionist entity that has violated international law since its creation in 1947, effectively by the UN and before the 1948 Nakba. You know, the reality is that the UN should be, even at the beginning of this ethnic cleansing, the continuation of the 1948 and the 1967 ethnic cleansings, the UN should have actually been forcing Egypt, for example, to open the Rafah border to allow humanitarian aid to enter Gaza into the so-called safe southern areas. Of course, we know that those areas in the south are not safe, because not only have the convoys evacuating civilians from the north to the south been bombed, including ambulances, but also Khan Yunis and various other, and Rafah itself has been heavily bombed and huge swathes of Khan Yunis and Rafah destroyed. So where was the UN from the 7th of October onwards, when it became absolutely clear what Israel was intending to do? They were announcing what their intentions were. So where was Guterres? Where was the UN? Where was the ICJ, the ICC, all of the so-called international law structures that should, at that point, from a humanitarian perspective, have forced the opening of Rafah? So I don't, you know, when somebody is saying to me, hopefully we can persuade Israel to open the Harem Shalom crossing, yeah, I don't hold out much hope for it, because we haven't seen very much proactive pressure being put upon the Zionist entity by the UN ever, actually.
Mm-hmm. And we did see one UN official resign weeks ago, looking at the world body, the way it was working and operating vis-a-vis this eruption in violence. Yusuf, again, the Palestinian Authority taking over in Gaza, we all know that the Palestinian Authority does not enjoy popularity or the support of all Palestinians. How do you see it happening, panning out, moving forward?
Well, they already announced that they are not willing to rule Gaza at the back of an Israeli tank. But as a matter of fact, there are no military posts, there are no police stations to come and rule Gaza. I mean, Gaza needs an urgent intervention to rebuild it, to relieve almost 2 million people. There is a war of starvation. When we're talking about the UN cannot force any UN resolution. You know, the UN headquarters is based in New York, and you know the stance of the U.S. administration giving Israel a green light. It's, as Vanessa said, it's powerless. You know, they cannot force Israel to stop. The whole world was
They can enforce
mobilizing
resolutions when it comes to Iran and Iraq, but
yeah, this
when
is
it comes to
the
Israel,
double standard policy,
not.
Of course. The Israeli genocidal war in Gaza exposed their hypocrisy. The UN should have provided humanitarian aid, but they withdrew their staff from the northern part of Gaza, despite many calls to send this aid. We know that the international community is not serious when it comes to condemn Israeli crimes. If we compare that with Ukraine, of course, we know the double standard policy. The whole world was waving the Ukrainian flags, the flags of Palestine. In some countries, they were outlawed. There is attacks on Palestinians in the United States. So this comparison shows that there is injustice going on. There is hypocrisy. The United Nations must exert its effort and show that it implement its slogans of spreading peace and putting an end to conflict, armed conflicts. The Palestinian people in Gaza are the victims of 75 years of Israeli oppression, ethnic cleansing. But as a matter of fact, people, they have steadfastness, they have high morale. Whatever Israel does, they will not leave Gaza. They will not become refugees again. The international community must pressure Israel to abide by international laws and to implement even one UN resolution.
Yeah. Speaking of, again, I'm going to stick with the UN a little bit. And Vanessa, speaking of the powerlessness of the United Nations, I wonder if they have weighed in on this. But just yesterday, I think, it was Israel, the war cabinet, so-called, announced hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, to build new settlements in the West Bank, even as we await the further extension, perhaps, of this truce.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what has been going on in the West Bank, as Yusuf described it, has been a continued trickle ethnic cleansing. We've seen the destruction of infrastructure, the destruction of connecting roads, the bombing of mosques, which is a war crime. There's no Hamas in West Bank. And yet the ongoing detentions, arrests, killings, I think up to 200 now, have been killed both by the IOF and by the what I call the ISIS settler militia operating inside the West Bank. We know from, I think it was a documentary that was made 2 years ago, The Cold Stones of Justice, where Daniela Weiss, the leader of the settlement forces, basically, explained how she used to collaborate with Ariel Sharon back in the 70s to ensure that the settlements prevented the creation of a Palestinian state at any point. And so that is what the settlements are for, this creep annexation of Palestinian territory, including, of course, the Jordan Valley, which is being targeted both by Netanyahu, who's an expansionist, revisionist, Zionist, and Smotrich, his finance minister, who even talked about this in Paris earlier this year, which will then fully encircle the West Bank again with the apartheid wall and with Israeli occupation. So the settlement project is ongoing even while Gaza is being ethnically cleansed. So it's clear that the intention is to ethnically cleanse all of Palestine. And of course we had, I think it was the Arabic account on Twitter, or X as it's now called, with the hand holding the whole of Palestine with the Israeli flag, which was then deleted. So their intention has been very clear, even to the point where the heritage minister has talked about nuking Gaza, where various people have floated the idea of using nerve gas against the resistance and fighters also, in the tunnels.
Yeah, and also a screenshot of someone in Israel, I think someone in the higher-ups, of looking for Gaza on Google Maps and not being able to locate it, which again supports what you have been saying over the past few minutes. Thank you very much. And with those comments, we are going to wrap up this show. Many thanks again to my guests, Yusuf Al-Hilou and Vanessa Bealey, for their contributions. Gaza Under Attack will be back with more. Until then, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts. Thank you.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
According to new figures, some patients in England are waiting up to 2.5 years for important diagnostic tests such as ultrasound, MRI, and CT scans. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Long and deadly delays facing patients in UK's public healthcare system have left a heavy toll on Britons, raising deaths more than fivefold between 2019 and 2022. A report published on Monday, 27th of November, in The Guardian revealed that about 8,000 people have been harmed and 112 have died as a result of deadly delays in medical care known as the National Health Service, the NHS. It cited figures from NHS England showing that patient deaths arising directly from care delays have risen more than fivefold over the last 3 years, from 21 in 2019 to 112 last year. The number of people who came to severe harm has also jumped from 96 to 152 during that same period. It added the overall number of people suffering some degree of harm in such circumstances has leaped from 3,979 in 2019 to 7,856 in 2022, a rise of 97%. Rachel Power, the chief executive of Patients Association, said, "These data are alarming and show quite clearly the human impact of the crisis in the National Health Service is having on individual patients." Rachel Power added, "We have been watching a disaster unfolding across the National Health Service and have repeatedly warned about the threat to patient safety because of it." The figures are taken from the National Health Service's National Reporting and Learning System, a database in which staff make an entry if they believe that a patient has had poor care. The Guardian obtained the statistics through a Freedom of Information Act request to NHS England, which only released the data after the Information Commissioner intervened. The Guardian said it should have released the figures after a month, but it took 5 months to do so. National Health Service England gave The Guardian anonymous details of 30 of last year's deaths. The NHS fatalities included a man seeking help due to cardiac arrest, who died after waiting 18 minutes for his 999 call to be answered by the ambulance service. He was dead by the time the ambulance crew arrived. A cardiac arrest patient is meant to be attended by an ambulance crew within 7 minutes of the phone call being made because his or her life is at risk. Several other deaths involved ambulance services stacking 999 calls in which people are left on hold because they do not have the resources to answer them quickly. In another case, a patient who was starting chemotherapy for follicular lymphoma was also diagnosed with hepatitis B. They were initially treated but were then not seen in the hepatitis clinic and did not receive a further dose of a drug called tenofovir. The patient then developed fulminant hepatitis B and died subsequently. The website Reddit has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to Health Watch, the so-called statutory patient champion, patients who face long delays for care in England can feel forgotten. Louise Ansari, the watchdog's chief executive, said, "We know that delays to care have significant impact on people's lives, putting many in danger. People told us about being removed from waiting lists, sometimes without being told why or without being told at all." Andrew Batty, a 68-year-old former NHS worker, said he needed monthly treatment for macular degeneration, an eye disease that can rapidly blur the central vision if left untreated. However, he added, "It's a battle, basically, to get your appointment. My last one was supposed to be 4 weeks and was 7.5 weeks, and we only managed to get one because of a cancellation." He added, "You feel frustrated, but you also feel scared, knowing that you could lose your eyesight." Adam Sampson, the chief executive of the Association of Optometrists, warned, "We're facing a health emergency where more people than ever are waiting longer than ever for sight-saving treatment." Adam Sampson added, "It's incomprehensible and absolutely tragic that patients are experiencing delays to such an extent that they suffer further sight loss that is both avoidable and irreversible." A recent report about long and deadly delays facing patients in the United Kingdom's public healthcare system pointed out that NHS England figures were almost certainly a significant underestimate of the problem. It said accidents and emergency doctors have estimated that as many as 500 people a week may be dying because of delays in getting an ambulance, receiving accidents and emergency care, or starting specialist treatment. According to ambulance companies, an estimated 6,000 patients were exposed to severe harm in December of 2022 alone. An analysis by the Liberal Democrats of NHS data has found that some heart attack and stroke patients are waiting more than 90 minutes for an ambulance to arrive. Daisy Cooper, the Liberal Democrats' health spokesperson, pointed out, "We know that a matter of minutes can make all the difference in emergencies, so it is heartbreaking to see ambulance delays are worsening and heart attack and stroke victims being left waiting for hours for help to arrive." The British government is entangled in a continued dispute with doctors over pay and labour conditions. The officials say repeated strikes by the disgruntled doctors disrupt the health service in Britain. Website Open Access Government has also reported on the same story and tells us more. According to new figures, some patients in England are waiting up to 2.5 years for important diagnostic tests such as ultrasound, MRI and CT scans. Responses to Freedom of Information requests by the Liberal Democrats show the longest waits were 2.5 years for an MRI scan, almost 2 years for an ultrasound scan, and a year for a CT scan. People with heart problems are among the worst affected. Examples from NHS Trust include a 49-week wait for an echocardiogram and a 475-day wait for an angiography. Under the NHS Constitution, patients should wait less than 6 weeks for diagnostic tests to occur. According to research from the House of Commons Library, commissioned by the Liberal Democrats, the target is for only 1% to wait more than 6 weeks, but now 25% of all patients do so. The figures also show that the waiting list for diagnostic tests has shot up by more than 500,000 to 1.6 million, a rise of 50% since 2019.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The genocidal war waged by the Israeli apartheid regime against the Palestinian people of Gaza continues to evoke anger and indignation around the world. Now, despite pressure from Western imperialist powers that support Israel's war crimes, many governments have come forward to openly support Palestinians in this crisis. One of such governments is the South African government. It has taken tangible action in support of Palestine by recalling its diplomats from Tel Aviv in protest to Israel's genocidal war on Gaza. South Africa also issued a formal reprimand to the Israeli ambassador for what was termed as his unfortunate conduct relating to the unfolding tragic war on Gaza. Additionally, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa told reporters during a recent visit to Qatar that his country is calling for an international criminal court investigation into Israel's genocide on Palestinians in Gaza. South Africa's parliament has also voted in favor of a motion calling for the closure of the Israeli embassy in Pretoria. Foreign Minister Naledi Pandor urged trade unions in the country to boycott goods from the Israeli regime due to the ongoing conflict in Gaza. Now, these moves are in tandem with South African people who have participated in dozens of demonstrations in solidarity with Palestinians. In Africa, South Africa is seen as a leader on many fronts. So, will other African countries follow in the footsteps of South Africa and take action against the Israeli apartheid regime? Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and this is Africa Today. In this week's episode, we are focusing on South Africa's unwavering support for the oppressed people of Palestine as they face a genocidal war perpetrated by the apartheid Israeli regime.
South Africa's strong pro-Palestinian stance. South Africa is among countries that have severed or suspended diplomatic relations with the Israeli regime due to its genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza.
South Africa's active stance reflects the pledge of solidarity with the Palestinian people expressed by President Cyril Ramaphosa last month in his closing remarks to the National Executive Committee of the country's ruling party, the African National Congress, ANC. He said that Palestine echoed the history of apartheid and South Africa's struggle against white minority rule.
We have a full understanding of how the people of Palestine have taken up this issue, because they are people, as many countries and leaders in the world have opined, that they have been under occupation for almost 75 years. And people under occupation who have been waging a struggle against an oppressive government that has occupied their land, but also a government that has in recent times been dubbed an apartheid state. As people and an organization that has struggled against an oppressive system of apartheid, we do pledge solidarity with the Palestinians. And as the African National Congress, we have always pledged our solidarity with them.
Well, for more on South Africa's pro-Palestinian stance, we have contacted Marin Jensen. He's the executive member of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign in Cape Town, South Africa. Thanks a lot for your time, sir, today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We also have with us today Azhar Sakur, the executive member of the Palestine Solidarity Alliance Youth League. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
The South African government has made its position clear in expressing support for Palestinians amid the ongoing genocidal war waged by the Israeli regime in Gaza. So let's start off with Mr. Azhar there. Now, what's the main factor behind South Africa's consistent support for Palestinians?
For many South Africans, looking at the history of South Africa, where we as South Africans have experienced apartheid and had freedom from apartheid, and we live in a democracy at the moment, many South Africans can draw parallels between occupied Palestine and South Africa during apartheid. And for that reason, there's been an outpour of support from South Africans for the Palestinian cause and the freedom of Palestinians. Very similarly, our government, currently our ruling party at the moment, the ANC, as well as other parties in South Africa, have taken a stance which has been towards the freedom of Palestine and in support of Palestinians, because they too have experienced apartheid and see the parallels between occupied Palestine and South Africa during apartheid.
Now, South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa recently revealed that his country has submitted a referral to the International Criminal Court, ICC, to investigate Israel's war crimes in Gaza. Let's take a listen.
As South Africa, we have accordingly, together with many other countries in the world, saw fit to refer this whole Israeli government action to the International Criminal Court. We have put through a referral because we believe that war crimes are being committed there.
Now, this is for you, Mr. Jansen. What's your take on this move by the South African president?
I think it's a very, very positive move on the part of our government. Many of us who have been part of the Palestine Solidarity Movement for many decades feel that it's long overdue. We know that the Israeli atrocities that it has committed since the 7th of October are probably the worst in its history since 1948. But there have been similar atrocities, especially against the people of Gaza. And, of course, in the West Bank, people have been randomly killed by the Israeli regime, detentions, house demolitions, constant abuse of the Palestinian people. So we feel that this is long overdue, but nevertheless, we're very pleased that the government, along with others in the world, like Bolivia, Venezuela, the Comores, Djibouti, and Bangladesh, have taken this very, very important step of referring Israel to the International Criminal Court.
South African Foreign Minister Naledi Pandor received a request to call the Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh to discuss getting humanitarian aid to Palestine. During the call, she reiterated South Africa's solidarity and support for the people of Palestine and expressed sadness and regret for the loss of innocent lives. This level of engagement with Palestinian freedom fighters is seen as quite significant.
Firstly, the South African foreign minister did publicly say afterwards that the call was in line with South Africa's readiness to engage with all parties in facilitating a dialogue in the current situation taking place in Palestine. For us in South Africa, the significance of this engagement with Palestinian freedom fighters is quite high. Looking at the history of South Africa, again, the South African ruling party during the time of apartheid, the ANC, was dubbed as a terrorist group. The ruling party of South Africa at the moment, back then, was dubbed as a terrorist group. And our former president, Nelson Mandela, was on the U.S. terrorist watch list until 2008. And this draws a parallel today to Hamas being called by the Western world as a terrorist organization. For many, they're seen as freedom fighters for Palestinians and are the elected government of Palestinians in Gaza.
South Africa is among a handful of African countries that had maintained diplomatic ties with both Palestine and the Israeli apartheid regime. Pretoria has strongly advocated for Palestinian freedom and backs the so-called two-state solution.
We've always insisted that the only solution for the problems in the Middle East, particularly between Israel and Palestine, is a two-state solution based on the 1967 borders as approved by the world community and the United Nations. Now, the violation of the rights of the Palestinians, that has manifested itself through the occupation of their land, through bringing in settlers so close and into their land, is something that is causing a great deal of concern and has possibly sparked off.
South Africa's parliament recently voted to shut down Israeli regime's embassy in the country. Now, the motion introduced by the Economic Freedom Fighters Party was passed with 248 votes in favor and 91 against. all members of South Africa's ruling African National Congress supported the closure of the Israeli embassy in the country. ANC Member of Parliament Mandla Mandela, a grandson of Nelson Mandela, has been leading calls on the government to end diplomatic ties with Israel.
We have a resolution that calls for the total downgrade of our embassy to a liaison status. Many of us have called for a total cut of ties. We don't even want to have any relations with apartheid Israel. And we want to say to the international solidarity movement, as much as they stood side by side with us, supported us, in particular in the Battle of Quito Guanevale in Angola, we call on them to likewise rise to the occasion and support Hamas and the Palestinian resistance in fighting their oppressor. And as we were able to collapse the apartheid regime of South Africa, we too will collapse the apartheid regime of Israel.
Now, this for Mr. Azhar. Now, what's your opinion on this historic move by South African lawmakers to close the Israeli embassy in the country?
Thank you for this question. Indeed, interesting developments that we're seeing in South Africa. For myself personally, as well as for the Palestine Solidarity Alliance Youth League, who I'm an executive member of, we welcome this. Thousands of South Africans have taken to the streets of South Africa, actually calling for the Israeli ambassador to be expelled from South Africa ever since the latest attacks on Gaza last month. As South Africans, it's important for us that we do not recognize and support racism, and we see Zionism and the Israeli government as a form of racism. In South Africa, there were actually two petitions on change.org that have been gaining a lot of momentum. The first with 32,800 signatories, and a second one with 8,500 signatories. And these petitions are the voices of South Africans calling the South African government to expel the Israeli ambassador from South Africa.
Thank you for that, Mr. Azhar Sakur. We now take a short break before we continue our topic on how Africa is isolating the Israeli regime. Stay with us.
South Africa's strong pro-Palestinian stance.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, and you're watching Africa Today. We are focusing on South Africa's strong pro-Palestinian stance and opposition to Israeli regime's genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza.
South Africans continue to march across the country to protest Israel's genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. The demonstrations, organized by several civil society groups, attract protesters from various religious denominations, including Muslims, Christians, and Jews.
Prominent South African anti-apartheid activist Reverend Alan Boysak recently took part in a pro-Palestinian demonstration in Cape Town. He called for the closure of the Israeli embassy in the country.
Palestinians can do nothing while their children are dying. They can do nothing with words when they are dying of hunger, when they are being bombed, when churches and mosques and hospitals are being bombed. Then words are no longer enough. I think what this government must do and must do immediately is that this embassy of the Israelis should be shut down.
Now, let's bring in Mr. Johnson. Now, how have these massive pro-Palestinian protests impacted on the government and parliament's policy regarding the Israeli regime?
One of the kind of lesser demands we've made over the years to our government is to kick out the Israeli ambassador from South Africa and to cut all diplomatic ties with Israel. Mm-hmm. And over the years, they haven't really listened. What they have done, they've criticized Israel, they've made statements in the media, but nothing substantial. And we have put lots of pressure on them, major, major protests and marches. But I think this time the difference is, of course, what Israel is doing to the Palestinians, especially in Gaza. And what's clear now, which we've been saying for many, many years, it's not new, that what Israel is doing to the Palestinians is effectively a genocide. Now it has become more obvious with all the killings, the mass murder, the targeting of schools, the targeting of hospitals, the targeting of journalists. It is now obvious to the government and the rest of the world that this is a genocide. So it's very hard for them to now resist, like in the past, our calls for doing something more substantial.
South Africa exports to the Israeli regime stood at around $357 million during 2022. This is according to the United Nations Comtrade database on international trade. The regime's exports to South Africa are currently estimated at $251 million annually.
There are increasing calls in South Africa for tangible action to boycott trading with the Israeli apartheid regime. Recently, the South African Foreign Minister, Naledi Pandor, urged trade unions in the country to boycott the Israeli regime. Let's take a listen.
So I hope out of this, NUMSA is going to lead a process where Comrade Irvin Jim and Comrade Chirwa will meet with their counterparts in all unions, whatever they are, and say, as South African trade union movement, let us lead. Let us lead. Let us agree for 1 month. None of our unions are going to lift any Israeli goods out of any transport. Just one thing.
A great statement there by Naledi Pandor. Now, this for Mr. Azhar. Now, what has been the impact of calls to boycott trading with the Israeli regime in South Africa?
This is actually a very interesting question, and it's something that, you know, again, drawing parallels to when South Africa was under apartheid, we know that one of the things that made a difference and helped South Africa get our freedom was boycott movements across the world. Similarly, the importance of targeted boycotts are quite important, specifically economic boycotts that are driven from targeted organizations that are either Israeli organizations or Israeli supporters and supporters of Israeli apartheid. In South Africa, there has been a huge drive for boycotts, and there has been a positive impact on boycotts. Boycotts in South Africa of pro-Israeli organizations have been taking place for a number of years, and we have seen a number of success stories in South Africa.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa says his country is ready to help mediate the conflict between Israel and Palestine. Experts believe South Africa can play a leading role in mediating between Palestinians and the Israeli regime.
South Africa is a major power on the African continent, economically and politically. However, in relation to Israel and Palestine, over the past few years, it has experienced a serious problem where many countries on the continent have been influenced by economic incentives, financial incentives by the Israeli regime, effectively forms of bribery, where they've won over the leaders of certain countries. And in fact, 2 years ago, there were attempts for Israel to gain observer status at the African Union, which was strongly resisted to their credit by the South African government and neutralized.
South Africa has been resolute in supporting Palestinians and opposing the Israeli regime, despite lots of pressure from Western powers and even the Zionist regime itself. Pretoria has been able to sustain this position despite the pressure from Zionists and imperialists.
Firstly, for those in our government from different political parties, we've seen support because of the parallels between South African apartheid many years ago and the current apartheid taking place in Palestine. It's important for the government to showcase to South Africans that they are continuing to support people who have been in positions like us.
South Africa is both an economic and political powerhouse in Africa. This country has been leading efforts to sensitize African nations about Israel's crimes.
South African Foreign Minister Naledi Pandor says that the unjust actions committed by the Israeli regime are contrary to the letter and spirit of the African Union.
The unjust actions committed by Israel offend the letter and spirit, as we have pointed out, of the Charter of the African Union. The African Union embodies the aspirations of all Africans and reflects their confidence that it can lead the continent through the practical expression of the goals of the Charter, especially on issues related to self-determination and decolonization. I don't know which African Union state would ever accept its territory being occupied by another country. The support the chairperson has expressed for Israel as an observer status in our union suggests, if we accept this as AU, that we accept infringement of our country's territorial integrity. This can never be accepted. Bias.
Now, our last question goes to Mr. Jansen. Now, how can this strong pro-Palestinian stance by South Africa be replicated in other African countries?
For Israel to gain observer status at the African Union, which was strongly resisted to their credit by the South African government and neutralized, but nevertheless, a big number of countries on the African continent have established more friendly relations with Israel, very similar to what's happening in the Middle East with Saudi Arabia and other countries establishing closer relationships with Israel. But South Africa has successfully resisted that. Now things have changed quite a bit because most Africans can see the atrocities that are being committed against the Palestinians. The genocide of the Palestinians is clear to all of them, and there is certainly pressure from below, from ordinary people, against their governments to take a stance against Israel. And that is going to be very, very difficult for these governments that establish friendly relations to resist. So the time now for South Africa to play a leading role in making sure that Israel is isolated from the African Union, but all countries on the continent, it's a very, very good period for South Africa to do that. And the fact that it has referred Israel to the ICC is a good leadership. It has shown good leadership in this regard.
Now, there you have it. South Africa is expected to play a leading role in isolating the Israeli apartheid regime in Africa. I would like to thank our guests today, Mr. Martin Jansen and Azhar Sakur, for their incisive analysis. That's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
A recent survey conducted by the Joseph Rowntree Foundation found 5.7 million low-income households in the United Kingdom lacking enough money for food, which it called a horrendous new normal. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. According to a new report, British households' food bills have been driven up by more than £600 over the past 2 years by the global climate emergency and soaring energy prices, warning of further increases to come in 2024. Sounding the alarm over the impact from increasing extreme weather patterns for food production, the Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit think tank said that global heating was directly contributing to the cost of living crisis. According to the analysis carried out by researchers from the universities of Bournemouth, Exeter and Sheffield, more extreme or unseasonal weather accounted for one-third of all food price inflation in the United Kingdom this year. Combined with the impact of soaring energy prices after the Russia-Ukraine war drove up gas, energy and fertilizer prices, it said British households had been hit by £605 in additional food costs in 2022 and 2023. While energy prices have fallen back this year, it warned that the impact from the climate emergency was actually increasing. Tom Lancaster, land analyst at the Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit, said, "Climate change is playing havoc with global food production, and this is inevitably feeding through to higher prices at the tills. Across 2022 and 2023, the climate emergency alone added the equivalent of 6 weekly shops to the average household food bill. According to the analysis, the cost of the climate crisis rose from £171 in 2022 to £192 in 2023, more than offsetting the effects of falling energy prices this year and having a greater impact than rising energy bills. Official figures show inflation in food and drink prices peaked at an annual rate of almost 20% earlier this year, the highest level since the 1970s, amid disruption to food supplies from weather events and soaring energy costs for producers. Food price inflation has fallen back in recent months but remains at historical highs of close to 10%, prices are also still near record highs after recent storms, including Storm Babe, flooded swathes of farmland, hitting UK potato and vegetable harvests in the run-up to Christmas. In 2022, drought hit production of basic foodstuffs such as potatoes and onions in the United Kingdom, followed by an unusually wet harvest in 2023 and then the hottest September on record. It comes after heat waves across the Mediterranean, India and South America this year all had a major impact on food production and food prices. Staples, including sugar, rice and tomatoes, were affected by extreme weather, such as droughts in India, while olive oil rose in price by 50% after 2 years of drought and heat waves in Spain and other major exporters in southern Europe. The situation could be worse next year, while the El Nino weather system